Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Judiciary Committee. We have a number of bills for a public hearing today and some work sessions as well. What we're going to do is we're going to start off with Senate Bill 608. Senator Bates is here, and we also have, I guess, an individual that will be calling in, or we will be calling and putting in place. So what I'm going to do is go ahead and open up the public hearing on 608. Drew, if you can give us the overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 608 establishes the Rural Medical Liability Stability Fund, Subsidy Fund, and places it in the state treasury, appropriates monies from general fund to Oregon Health Authority to develop and implement program, directs Oregon Health Authority to subsidize physician malpractice premiums for certain rural physicians and nurse practitioners along a scale determined by practice area, and takes effect upon passage.
All right. Thank you. Now, my understanding is that we're going to take public testimony today. Apparently, there's still some work and ongoing that we're going to need some amendments to it, but we felt this was an appropriate time for us to get the stuff on the record, and then we can move forward. And Senator Bates, is there anyone else you'd like to have part of a panel, or did you want to solo?
I invite anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill to come forward right now. Okay? And sit up here with me.
All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and
start off,
and then we'll bring up the next set.
For the record, I'm Senator Alan Bates, District 3 in Southern Oregon. And to be clear about this, this bill does not directly affect me. I am not in a rural area. So you may also know that I'm a physician in primary care in Southern Oregon, and that should probably be on the record also. I'm going to give you a little history on this, if I could, just for a few minutes, and bring you up to speed on it so you can have an understanding of the situation and what we're really trying to accomplish with this bill. About 4.5 years ago, Governor Kulongoski and I and some others sat down and talked about the difficulty we're having in rural Oregon maintaining health care in those areas. We had a steady erosion and loss of primary care physicians. We had a loss of nurse practitioners. We are losing the ability to do obstetrics in regional areas of rural areas of the state. And we were actually losing what I felt was the fabric of rural parts of Oregon due to a lack of health care in those areas. We also looked at it from the point of view of economic stimulus. When you lose your physician, when you lose your nurse practitioner, when your hospital's at risk of closing, when you can't do obstetrics and other basic things you need to do in rural areas, you find it's very difficult to get industry to come in and have jobs there because nobody wants to move to a town or a city where the nearest health care is 100 miles away. So we started looking at the things that we could do to help stabilize the workforce in those areas and what could really make a difference. Well, there are other bills and other systems and other programs to try to do that. One of the ones you'll probably hear about is loan repayment, which has been effective to a degree, but the problem with loan repayment we commonly run into is once that loan is repaid, after 4 or 5 years, the nurse practitioner or doctor, in many cases, leaves the community. At least they had them for 4 or 5 years, but it's not a permanent situation. We also deal with our A and B hospitals in a way that they get paid for costs, which is something we also need to maintain. What this bill has done, though, has been the first time we've seen a stabilization. It has been very, very effective for the last 4 years to have a program running in rural Oregon where we subsidize the medical malpractice premiums paid by physicians and nurse practitioners. And putting this program together 4 years ago, we really went through some difficulties. And I see Senator Cruz smiling there because he was part of those discussions. We had a very difficult time of defining what rural Oregon really is for the purposes of this program. And I want to point out some things about that are important. Of areas in far eastern parts of the state or on the coast or other areas. There's another overlay you have to lay on that kind of a map, and that overlay is what does the patient mix look like in those areas? And this may be a little down the weeds for you, but it's important because it relates directly to this program. In most places in rural Oregon, you have very small amounts of what we call commercial insurance. These are insurers that pay twice to three times higher than what Medicaid or Medicare pays. And so when you're in a community that has a very small amount of commercial or no commercial insurance, most of the patients you're seeing either have no insurance, They have Medicare, which pays very low rates in this state, or they have Medicaid, which pays low rates. And so one of the problems for people in rural parts of the state who are practitioners is just making a living, because people are in a situation where they really can't pay the kind of salaries that physicians, nurse practitioners can make in big cities. Plus, the work is harder. You're up nights and weekends. You may be the only one in that community that's giving health care. You're on call 24/7. It makes it very, very difficult. So an ongoing program that reduces your costs, and one of the major costs in running a practice in those areas is medical malpractice insurance, one that continually reduces your overhead, is very significant, not only for recruiting people, but for keeping them there. And when I talk to our managed care organizations in Medicaid, I ask them, what's the most important tool you have for recruiting and maintaining nurse practitioners and physicians in the rural areas of the state? They say this program is the number one that works for them the best. It keeps people there, and it's a great recruiting tool for them, and it's stabilized our rural population of providers. So you may see some, you will see some minor changes coming through on this as far as amendments are concerned, but the basic program is, as I have outlined it for you this morning. We want to maintain this program. We want to keep it going. We want to keep the same areas being covered to be covered in the future. The real question here, frankly, is not this bill. We do need this bill to be passed, and I appreciate giving us a hearing, and I hope you'll have a work session very soon. The real question is something that's not in your hands. That is, the funding for this is going to be very difficult to find. It's not really that much money. When you think about the healthcare industry in the state of Oregon, it's a $22 billion a year business, and we're talking here of probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 or $7 million a year to pay these subsidies. We need to find that money, and it's going to be a job for another part of our system, which I think probably is going to be end up in my committee down in Ways and Means. So I would encourage you to please look at this bill very, very carefully. Place whatever amendments you think are appropriate into it. But we want a bill coming to us that does the job we want to do. Our real task here is going to be funding this program and keeping it funded, and we're going to work very hard on that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We do have Dr. Kevin Johnston on the phone. And did you want to be here present when he gives his testimony?
I think I will stay for a few minutes to hear testimony from all parties to make sure if there's any questions that have to be answered, I'd be glad to stay for those too.
All right. Unless we have a question for Dr. Bates right now, what I'd like to do is go ahead and get Dr. Johnston's testimony since he's on hold waiting for us, and I know he's got his practice to take care of. So, Katie, am I ready to just hit the on button?
Exactly.
Good morning, Dr. Johnston.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Floyd Przanski, Senator, and we're here in committee, and thank you for being part of our hearing today. I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to be able to give your testimony. Are you hearing us all right?
I am now, yeah, you bet. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and ask you to go ahead, and if you'll state your name for the record and then give us your testimony, and then we'll take it from there.
Okay. My name is Kevin Johnston, family physician from Burns, Oregon, here to provide some testimony on the rural medical liability fund renewal discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee, for having me. I really appreciate it. I really appreciated the opportunity to speak to you face to face last May, and I wish I could have been there today. Unfortunately, we're in a situation where one of my two partners moved back east about a month ago. So Dr. Spence and I are now covering the entire community, and so the opportunity for me to leave this community has shrunk significantly. So thank you for putting up with the telephone aspect of it. I hope you have my written testimony there from last May. I think Brian was going to provide it to you. If you don't have it, I think you will receive a copy of it. Let me just tell you a little bit of background as far as my partner, Dr. Spence, and I, what our experience has been in this community. We moved here in 2002 and pretty rapidly took over all the obstetrical care in the community, as well as being responsible, obviously, for all the other care that needs to occur in the community, including hospitalized patients and emergency room care. And all the outpatient services that need to occur in a community like this. We had a third partner, as I just mentioned, who left. We have a partner we're hoping will come in September, but right now it's just the two of us. That's not new from the obstetrical piece. It's always just been the two of us, and I think I couldn't hear the introduction well, but I think some of the points are well taken. Obstetrics is a 24-hour a day, 7-day a week adventure, and with only two providers giving that coverage, you really both have to be on call every day, all day, because you never know when you're going to need to do a cesarean, which we generally want two partners in the operating room, and you never know when you're going to have a bad baby. And if there's a baby that needs help, one partner can't be down at the pub while the other one's working. So it is quite a commitment. There are a lot of joys that come from it, certainly, as there are a lot of joys that come from rural practice in general. Most of us, I think, wouldn't be here unless we really felt strongly about our communities and the people that we take care of. Having said that, though, the business model of trying to maintain this commitment has gotten more and more difficult, and quite honestly, more difficult even since I talked to you last. Liability insurance is certainly a big concern, as are a lot of other concerns that affect all businesses, including the cost of just providing health insurance for my own employees. The liability piece, however, is substantial when it comes to making the decision about whether or not to stay in a rural practice, and specifically whether or not to continue to provide obstetrical services, and I'll try and touch on that briefly. I spoke with the hospital board member the other day, and he asked me, what is the tipping point? If OHP cuts 19% of your reimbursement this year, is that the tipping point? If the liability fund goes away, is that the tipping point? If you don't get another partner in the next 6 months, is that the tipping point? And to be quite honest with you, I can't tell you the answer. I wake up every morning, I work. End of the year, I look and see how my business did, and I look back and think how hard I worked for it, and I decide whether or not I'm willing to do it another year. And I think there are a lot of us in rural practice that are in that situation. I don't know that any of us could tell you a number or, you know, what one thing is going to be the, you know, really the last card that's going to knock the whole house down. I don't think we're going to know until we get there. And that's what makes every one of these individual issues a little bit scary. The testimony I gave, you know, last time, basically, there were a few points that I'd like to emphasize, and I had the advantage of testifying last, so some of the physicians that were there had made some points that I didn't want to belabor, but obviously, we need to maintain health care in rural areas, and I'm just going to talk to my own experience, because I can't tell you what things are like in John Day and in Lakeview or Baker, but in our setting, we are 130 miles from the closest referral center. And I feel like I need to say that because someone told me the other day, we want you to come over and meet with a legislator, but he can only meet with you at 7:45 in the morning, and I know you don't want to have to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to drive. Now, any of you that know where Burns is, that really know where Burns is, knows that I'm about 6.5 hours away. This is an incredibly isolated setting, and there may be a lot of debate on what needs to constitute a true rural practice, but I think I can speak from what a true rural practice is. In order to get a patient that is pregnant or having complications of any sort, pregnancy or otherwise, it's at least 2 to 3 hour transport time by the time you even get Air Life here and get that patient to the referral hospital. So we are fairly remote, and if we don't have a broad spectrum of services available here, it's not going to change whether or not people get sick. It's not going to change whether or not people get pregnant. It's just going to change our ability to take care of those patients in an emergency. And so one of the reasons to maintain obstetrical practices in these rural communities, and for that matter, a broad spectrum of care in these rural communities, is that we're going to pay for it one way or the other. Folks are still going to get sick. They're still going to have emergencies. They're going to come in with obstetrical complications. If we are not prepared to do it anymore because our hospitals have stopped providing that care, our physicians have stopped providing that care, it doesn't mean that those patients won't be here. It just means we will not be capable of caring for them in the manner that they deserve. one of the things that I spoke to briefly last time was some of the economics of us losing obstetrical services in particular in the rural communities. Dr. Spence and I think last year, ended up delivering about 60 patients out here. And some of those actually weren't our patients. They were patients that were driving through that had emergencies and needed to be delivered. But of all the patients we delivered, 48% of them were on some form of Oregon Health Plan, were Medicaid patients. In that setting, if we have no nurses that are able to provide obstetrical services, if we have no providers that are able to provide obstetrical services, those patients will be flown from this community. A flight currently is between $12,000 and $25,000. So the math, it fairly quickly adds up so that, you know, if we lose even one community, you know, a John Day, a Lakeview, a Burns, if we lose obstetrical services in one community, we are still going to outlay a fair amount of dollars just to try and get those people taken care of in a different setting. And so that will drive the cost up significantly, I think, to the state on the other end. And you know that can happen. I mean, we've already seen, you know, Reedsport no longer provides obstetrical services. Prineville has stopped providing obstetrical services. And those are communities that actually have more doctors, have maybe a little bit more leeway in the demands that are placed on them. These other communities, eventually, I think you're going to see something happen. Is this the tipping point? I don't know. As I mentioned, I don't know if this is the tipping point. If decreasing OHP reimbursement is the tipping point, I just can't tell you. But all I can tell you is that all of these things together have a significant impact on whether or not the model is still viable to be able to provide care and make a living. I guess lastly, the other piece, and I think it was maybe addressed a little bit in the introduction, is recruiting. Dr. Spence and I mentioned we've been here for 9 years. We've recruited one partner in that period of time, and that partner now is in Georgia. We brought a young lady out in January who is an excellent physician and chief resident at her Alaska program, and she loved the community, she loved the practice, but then she informed us that your practice is not compatible with having a family life. And I told her, please don't tell my wife and children that, because I've fooled them for 9 years. There are multiple things that are going to determine whether people go into rural practice, and I can tell you there are lots of things that you're aware of, and I don't need to belabor that point. But this is one piece, because there are only a few physicians being trained anymore that will do the kind of medicine that we need in our rural communities, that will do this broad spectrum family practice, obstetrics, emergency care. We have to compete against Washington, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, and these physicians they're mobile. They are looking at these other practices to decide what is the climate that is going to allow me to both have a reasonable lifestyle, a decent income, and not kill myself. And this is one piece. Loan repayment's a piece. This is a piece. There are multiple things that go into making that decision. This has been one of the tools that we've utilized in the past to get people interested. And I think if it goes away, it hurts us from a recruiting standpoint as well. As a state, we could spend millions of dollars trying to recruit new physicians to go into rural programs. But if we don't keep the rural physicians that we have, if we don't have this tool to convince physicians to consider our state and our rural areas, I think we do ourselves a significant disservice. And I'll leave it at that. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Johnston. What I'm going to do is open up the panel. At this point, yourself and Senator Bates are the two that have given testimony, and I know both of you have schedules that are demanding. So let's see if there's any questions for them. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bates, we're not messing with the current definition of rural in this. Would that be correct?
That is correct. If there's been a change, I'm not aware of it.
Okay. A couple more, if I could, Mr. Chair. Is the bill written the way you want it?
Essentially, I have a little concern about one section, which I'll speak to, and that's I'm going to look at the premiums for primary care physicians doing obstetrics. When I read through it, I saw that they're being reimbursed at 60% of their medical malpractice premium. I'm going to see if they have a significant difference in what that premium is compared to people doing obstetrics as an OB-GYN specialist. I want to look at that carefully.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Senator Bates, while you're looking at that, you can also take a look at C&D, which is fuzzy at this point because it allows the authority to reimburse up to, and I thought we had a pretty rigid grid, and so we need to look at to make sure that the grid that we're creating here is the same grid that we had before, if that's possible.
If I may answer, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Senator Cruz, I'm comfortable with C. You need anesthesiology, you need general surgery, you do C-sections, and there's areas you need, if you have pediatrics, you need for referral and referral to a rural situation. Geriatrics is becoming a big issue in rural areas. They're primarily internal medicine specialists. I'll look at D carefully.
Okay.
Let me just stop just for a second. We're talking C's and D's, and people are listening and committee members.
I'm sorry, Section 2,
yeah.
C and D.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, Mr.
My
Chair.
Apology.
You bet.
Mr. Chair, if I could, Senator Bates, my question on Section 2, sub C and D is the language that says up to. It's not the list, it's the reimbursement rate. And I thought we were fairly solid that list in C was at 40%, and I would hate to see somehow it be diminished because of the language.
I understand.
Okay, that's the question I have, and I would invite you to take a look at that. We can talk about it and see if we need amendments. Clearly, Mr. Chair, this is a good bill. We need to replace a fund that we fully utilized, and we need to do it a different way, and hopefully we can get this down to Ways and Means in a relatively short period of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you, Senator.
Any other questions? Okay. All right. So I think this takes care of for the two doctors. Dr. Johnson, again, I want to thank you very much for your time and your testimony. I do want to let you know that we do have your written testimony. It has been provided to the committee, and it is definitely part of the record. And again, thank you for taking time out of your day and giving us your perspective, which is very valuable for this committee and for the record. Is there anything else that you'd like to conclude with, Dr. Johnson, before we sign off?
No, I just thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you, and look forward to talking to you again.
All right, thank you again. Have
thank
a great
you.
Day.
Yep.
All right. Senator Bates, you're going to stay by for a little bit. What I'm going to do...
I'm just going to stay to answer questions right now.
All right. Can I ask you to step back? What I'm going to do is bring two more people up, and then we'll have a panel, and if we need to bring you back up for any more technicals, we'll do that. So, are you Marlene?
I am Marlene.
All right, great. Teresa, why don't you come on up, and Scott.
And Marlene, since you've been
sitting there patiently, I'm going to let you start us off. Give us your name for the record, and then we'll take it up from there.
All right. Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, I am Marlene Doucette. I'm a family nurse practitioner and a women's health care nurse practitioner. And I'm currently practicing in Lincoln City at a small-run nurse practitioner-only clinic. I'm in partnership with Meg Portwood, a family nurse practitioner who testified last year to this committee regarding SB 608 and the continuance of that funding for nurse practitioners. And I'm here because I'm in support of continuing the Oregon Rural Medical Malpractice Reinsurance Program to continue after 2011, and to stress the importance of including nurse practitioners in that coverage. In my clinic, we see approximately 100 patients a week, and they're varied in complexity, and we see pediatrics, we see geriatric patients, we see sports physicals. My partner sees some OB, and she transfers their care at the end of pregnancy to one of the family practice doctors in town. and we see the indigent, and we do a lot of self-pay and sliding scale in our office to allow patients that don't have much money to pay as little as $5 a month and still get medical care. We are one of the few nurse practitioner-run rural clinics in Oregon. I think there's about five of us. There's approximately 54 nurse practitioners receiving benefits from this program. And how it helps our clinic is that when we receive our small, it's not large reimbursement because we're in the 40% of reimbursement, we put that back into our clinic. My clinic's been in existence for approximately 34 years in our community. And Meg Portwood, who is my partner, has been there since that beginning. And she has run into many challenges keeping a clinic open with a very limited budget and still practicing offering good quality care to the community. And so we put that money back into blood pressure cuffs, just replenishing kind of worn out equipment that we need in our clinic. And we do appreciate it. And it does help us stay afloat. And the other topic, a lot has been discussed, and I agree with everything that's been said, actually, and you have my testimony before you. But as far as recruitment, I'd just like to also add on to what has already been said about recruitment. When I came to Oregon, I'm from L.A., so I've always worked in a big city, and I've always wanted to work in a rural community. That's been something I've wanted to do in my career. And I'm getting towards the end of my career. When I came to Oregon, I had to go back to college to meet the standards of Oregon State to practice as a family nurse practitioner. So I went to a postmaster's program in Gonzaga, and I was able to do my precepting with Meg Portwood in a rural area, and that's how I ended up in this clinic. And we do a lot of that. We train nursing students, nurse practitioner students from Oregon and Washington, and we have at least one student flowing through our clinic almost at all times. And we hope that we light the spark so they will come and practice somewhere in rural Oregon and get that drive. And without our clinic, I don't know if that would happen for a lot of students. And as far as the community, if we weren't in existence, if we weren't able to maintain those 100 patients a week might be flooding that ER or not being able to be absorbed and not get care. So I think we're very important, and nurse practitioners can practice alone without a physician. Many of us do practice with physicians in rural communities, and we do make much less than if I worked in the city. 10 years ago, I was making more than I do today working in Los Angeles. And so it's not about the money, it's about the commitment, and we appreciate your support with this bill and continued support.
All right, thank you. Scott, why don't you go next? And just to let you know, we do have your testimony as well.
Okay. Great. Well, Chair Prozanski, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health, and we have been honored to be part of the administration of this program since it began. And since the legislation passed in 2003 to create the program, our office, the Office of Rural Health, takes care of the application and certification of meeting all the criteria, eligibility criteria for the program. And then SAFE, of course, is the organization that actually takes care of the fiscal end of it. I'm here to express my support for the continuance of this program. It's one of the few tools we have to encourage rural physicians and nurse practitioners to continue practicing in an environment where they typically work more hours and earn a lower income. When malpractice premiums began to rise in the late 90s, rural physicians who specialized in OB and gynecology were particularly hard hit. They began to drop the obstetrics part of their practice. No one was delivering babies in an increasing number of rural communities. Physicians in other specialties were also seeing large premium increases, and that played a significant factor in the decision of some to just simply leave the state. The Rural Medical Liability Financial Reinsurance Plan, also known as MedMal, began with the passage of House Bill 3630 in 2003, and the projection at that time is that $40 million would be needed for the program over a four-year period of time. As the first four-year period of time started coming to a close, we were able to extend the program in 2007 with the funds that were left available by making just a few changes. Some of the changes that were made in 2007 lessened the financial impact, enable us to continue the program for a bit longer. For example, physicians in the urbanized areas, the urbanized according to the federal definition of Jackson County, were excluded with the exception of those who practice obstetrics. Participants were required to attest that they're willing to see Medicare and Medicaid patients. Nurse practitioners were added to the program, and the benefit was lowered for some physicians who do not practice obstetrics. And Vice Chair Cruz, I think to your question, the reason the word up to 40% is still in the bill is because we were trying to get the money to stretch all the way through calendar year 2011, and SAFE had the ability to lower the subsidy. So the MedMal program will sunset at the end of this calendar year, and you'll hear from others today about the negative impact that will likely have on the rural healthcare workforce. Rural Oregon communities already have proportionately far fewer healthcare providers available to them than their urban counterparts, and I urge you to pass Senate Bill 608 so that we can keep those we do have in place in rural communities. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. We're going to take testimony from Teresa Miller, and then we'll open it up for the panel. Thanks, Teresa.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Teresa Miller, and I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'll keep my comments very brief because I think the testimony before me really covered kind of the highlights of the program. So I'll just say that, you know, funding for this program, at least so far, came from a credit against workers' compensation assessments paid by SAFE. And these assessments are collected from Oregon employers for the administration of Oregon's workers' compensation system. Under the law, the program costs were capped at $40 million based on a one-time surplus in this workers' compensation account. However, I think as we all know, that surplus no longer exists, and so this account is not a sustainable source of funding for the program. And with that, you have my written testimony, and again, you'll see some repetition in that, but I also included some attachments to my testimony that provide additional information related to this issue, including a breakdown of program expenditures by year, a breakdown of participation by county, and a chart illustrating medical professional liability insurance rates and rate changes over the last 10 years. So with that, I'll let you move on. Thank you
very much. Are there any questions or comments?
Chair, just comments. Scott, you're right. I know why we made it flexible just to stretch it, but my suggestion at this point is if we find a secure funding source, it's no longer flexible, and the 40% becomes the true 40% we intended.
All right, Senator Wessett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. This program is essential to our Senate district. Lake County is a frontier county. Without obstetrics in Lakeview, it's about 100 miles to Klamath Falls. It's about 3.5 hours to Bend. It's about 4.5 hours to Dr. Johnston's practice in Burns. If for some reason the service isn't available in Klamath, it's another 2 hours over to Rogue Valley and Medford. So I mean, it's a huge thing for us. I believe at this time there's, according to Ms. Miller's written testimony, there's 81 physicians in that five county or in the three counties. There would be Lake, which is the frontier county, and Crook and Klamath, which are rural counties. There's 81 physicians that are currently accessing this program, and in the total of the five counties that I represent, there's 126. It's huge for our district.
All right, thank you. Any other comments or questions? I want to thank you all very much for coming forward and giving us the testimony. Let me ask if there's anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 608. Not seeing anyone before Senator Cruz runs off anywhere, just to let him know that he will be volunteering to help facilitate for the committee with his certified smarts on the healthcare side. So with that, thank you, Senator Cruz, and we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 608. And we're going to change counsel.
Chair, members of the committee.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing, and I think what I'm going to do, looking at this, we'll open up the public hearing on both of the bills, mm-hmm. Senate Bill 677 and Senate Bill 678. Bill, why don't you give us the overview for the two and what the differences are, and then we'll call up panels since we have a number of people here to testify.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 677 and 678 right. come to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee. What I'd like to do, if I could, is walk through 678 because they are substantially similar except for one provision in Section 3 of 678. This is to address a issue of where technology has got ahead of the law, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. When, for example, displaying sexually explicit conduct, when it was originally passed, no one anticipated that there would be cell phones, let alone cell phones with cameras on them. And what has become a common occurrence in this country right now is teenagers taking pictures of their intimate parts and other people's intimate parts and sending them to each other, which under Oregon law is currently mandatory minimum sentence of 70 months, and under measure initiative 73, if they do it more than once, which most of them do, because they send the picture to more than one person more than one time, it could be 25 years. What I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is walk through 678, looking at Section 1, except as otherwise provided in subsection 3 of this section, in any prosecution under the following statutes, and I have provided to you in your handout a copy of the particular material. So it says 163.670, which is using child in displaying of sexually explicit conduct. And then the next one is 163.684, which is encouraging child sexual abuse in the second degree. 163.686, encouraging child abuse in the second degree. 163.687, encouraging child abuse in the third degree. 163.688, possession material depicting sexual explicit conduct of a child in the first degree. 163.689, possession of material depicting sexual explicit conduct of a child in the second degree. 163.693, failure to report child pornography. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, also in the material that I provided you, if you look back at 163.665, visual recording of sexual conduct of children, and it defines sexually explicit conduct under Section 3, as you go through it, most of it's pretty self-evident, until you get to Section F, which is lewd exhibition of sexual or other intimate parts. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this lewd language has been challenged on constitutionality, and in the 1993 under State v. Myers, the court did find that term constitutional. But in doing so, it really didn't leave anyone with much guidance as to what the term lewd meant. It just said it's been used before, and it's referred to the dictionary. It says, indeed, there is a large body of case law recognizing the term lewd when used in a criminal statute to define an offense connoted as unlawful indulgence in lust or an eagerness of sexual indulgence. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in 2002, in State v. Chinanelli, Representative Judge Brewer said, looking at the same statute, said, basically, sexual conduct is lewd because it is unlawful, then a statute that makes it unlawful because it is lewd is circular and provides little guidance as to what specific conduct was tended to be prohibited. Chair, members of the committee, where this becomes significant is in the range of conduct that could happen with one of these phones. So if I could proceed on what this does, it creates an affirmative defense for two different groups. The defendant was under 18 years of age at the time of the offense, or the defendant was less than 3 years older than the victim at the time of the offense. So that would mean a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old. And the reason for this, if you take, if these parties were to have a sexual relationship, it's not a felony.
if they were to take pictures of each other and send it to a couple of people, as they're prone to do, often do, it is a felony. And some people think there's not a logic to that. So that's why that particular provision is included. But this doesn't mean the affirmative defense gets you off. It basically says under Section 2, it creates a new crime that puts you in there. The offense of inappropriate use of sexual image is defined in Section 2 of this Act. Now, if you look at Section 3, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the affirmative defenses do not apply. If the state proves beyond a reasonable doubt the time the offense was committed, the victim was under 12, or the defendant has a previous conviction of finding in the juvenile court for inappropriate use of sexual images. Now, you'll look at subsection B, and this creates two other outs, but it only applies to the second part. And this may be the result of possible communication error between the drafter, Josh Markey, and myself. Okay? Not a drafting error, it's just that we may have got this wrong in communication. So this says the subsection 1B of this section does not apply if the defendant transferred the recording, it basically for consideration. So if they transfer the recording, we're getting paid for it, then the defense wouldn't apply. Or you are using the visual depiction for the purposes of blackmail. So if I could then go on to the second page of the bill, I'm going to Section 2. What Section 2, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, basically does, basically says, okay, we've given you one bite of the apple above, but if the DA wants to give you more than one bite of the apple, it builds in discretion as it relates to that. Now, Section 3 is in Senate Bill 678. It's not in 677. And this is one of the issues after we went through this and questions came up. We just weren't exactly sure what to do. And so it is a policy question. What this basically says is if you have a victim that's under 12 and a defendant that's under 18 and he's taken a picture of the person under 12, which could range from very serious, something that doesn't leave anything in the imagination, to something that could be as innocuous as a rear end, okay? This leaves it up to the judge. It gives the judge discretion. As chair members of the committee, this new offense is not included in 181.594, so it's not a registrable sex offense. As chair members of the committee, that's the basics of this bill. From the research that I did over the interim, this is a problem throughout the United States. Other legislatures are wrestling with the same issue. And there are studies that show the significant number of teenagers are doing this.
All right. First, before we take any testimony, let's see what council questions.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, so I'm assuming the only real difference between 678 and 677 is Section 3 and 671.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay, so
that gives discretion to the judge where the victim is under 12 and the defendant is under 18.
Okay. Thank you.
Doesn't mean they get off. It means the judge could say, no, this is very explicit conduct. This is a serious situation. You have you're faced with a mandatory minimum sentence of 70 months.
All right.
Can I
have
a question?
Yes.
Thank you, counsel. So is 678, I'm assuming because they're two separate bills, that this is an alternate to 677, so you wouldn't necessarily adopt both. It would be one or the other, correct?
Chair members of the committee, they are alternate bills. They're similar except for Section 3, and what it does is it puts the policy issue before the committee.
All right.
I have
that,
a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead.
Bill, you mentioned something about a place where you and you were working with Josh Markey had a miscommunication about what was, something ended up in the bill that you're not sure of, and I'm just not sure where that part is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I meant Josh Maspey, the drafter. I'm sure Josh Markey and I may have
that's
had
why,
some.
That's why I was.
That's
okay.
A miscommunication in the stove.
You might have here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would be on page 1, line 17, where it says line 22, where it says subsection 1 via this section does not apply. And I guess what the alternative would be, if, once again, it's a policy issue. If you want the affirmative defenses not to apply to a, someone who's under 18, who has used the visual depiction for blackmail or for the purposes of monetary gain, then what we would do is simply take out the part that says subsection 1B of the section does not apply and renumber it, so which you would have the affirmative defense not applying
for the line 22.
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct, Senator.
All right. Just to point that out, so you're saying on that particular one, when you say blackmail, extortion, where the individual that took the pictures, holding those pictures over the person's head, or say to get some type of financial gain?
That's correct.
So would that also include if someone said, I want your lunch or I'm going to print these out?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me read it. Subsection 1 of the section does not apply if the state proves beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant used a visual recording, visual depiction, participant engaged in sexually explicit conduct to commit coercion as defined in ORS 163-275 or theft by extortion as defined in 164-075. I would have to go back and look at those statutes. I do have my...
Okay, well, we're going to have a work group on this. I know that there's some more work that needs to be done, plus it's only public hearing today. I've raised that because I want to make certain, since we're talking in the context of kids, mm-hmm. I could see in a lunchroom where someone could make some statement and that could potentially put them in a position that was not intended. But I want us to be able to discuss that and make certain when we pass this out, we have set a record as to what the intent of the committee is, as well as what the legislature intends to have when it moves forward. All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and open it up for testimony. What I want to do is bring a panel of three up, Elizabeth Kushaw, Doug Harkerod, and Shannon White. I know, the second panel. Well, we got them both open.
They've
already opened up.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if you want Craig to give the more neutral perspective before the three of us.
No.
You like it?
I like y'all three being together.
Well, we can come back together.
Neutral. I mean, I got another two that are neutral. I've got the score sheets here in this program. Well, so we did open up a public hearing on both bills. So if you're going to make distinctions about either bill, make certain you put that on the record so those who are tracking know which of the two bills you're referring to. And whoever wants to start off.
Okay. For the record, my name is Shannon White. I'm the Associate Director with Partnership for Safety and Justice. We are an 11-year-old statewide membership organization that advocates on public safety issues. For us, that means advocating both for victims of crime and people who've been convicted of crime. And we are here today because these bills address two issues that we focus on. One, youth justice, how juveniles are treated under the law, and also victim accountability, and believe that both of these bills, at least the intent of them, supports both a need for some level of accountability and an understanding of how juveniles should be treated differently under the law. Because there are so many experts, and I think Mr. Taylor has given sort of an overview, I will leave that part of testimony out, and just address the issue of sexting in our culture and in our statutes. As Mr. Taylor said, we have an existing child pornography statute that has been used to prosecute sexting cases in Oregon. It carries a mandatory 70-month sentence and is an incredible hammer, particularly in the juvenile justice system. This situation was aggravated by the passage of Measure 73, which then said that if there were multiple offenses, which is common in sexting cases, a juvenile could be subjected to a 25-year prison sentence. So I understand that these bills are an attempt to fix those problems, and we are certainly supportive of that and are thankful that there will be a work group to help kind of iron out some of the details of this. Just a few quick facts on sexting. As Mr. Taylor said, a number of states have started to address it. A poll by the Pew Research Center found that 14% of youth had at least received a sexually suggestive text message. Other polling by numerous other groups has shown anywhere from 19 to 31% of kids between the ages of either 12 to 18 or 13 to 19 have received or sent these kinds of messages. We believe this phenomenon is particularly acute for young people because of what we know about adolescent development. As I'm sure you all have heard before, new research is increasingly showing that young people's brains are still in a state of development, actually into their early 20s. And the part of the brain that they can identify is under the most transition during this time period is actually the part of the brain that, as you probably guessed if you have teenagers, is the part that can think about long-term consequences and impulse control. So we feel like sexting is kind of a melding of these two problems, where suddenly the impulsivity of a child or a young person is matched with technology that makes it really quick to make a big mistake. And we do want to acknowledge that in some situations, these cases can have devastating impacts for people involved. When, you know, suggestive photos get shown to a huge group of kids within a school, it can be devastating, and there does need to be some level of accountability. And some of the laws that are working on in other states like New Jersey are really actually focusing on getting schools to address some of those issues, in fact getting cell phone companies to address some of those issues to try and get education out there to help slow down some of that impulsivity. I want to bring to your attention a case that was highlighted in a Willamette Week story in December of 2010. And in this case, there were actually two young women, ages 16 and 19, who fell in love and apparently took sexually suggestive photos of one another. The younger girl's mother was not happy that she was in a lesbian relationship and handed the phone over to the police. The older girl was given a felony conviction for that and has now had to kind of give up her dream of becoming a child social worker because it will probably be impossible with a sex crime conviction. Unfortunately, this current law probably wouldn't account for them because I think there were slightly over 3 years between the two, which may be a conversation for later. But you know, that case, it does appear that possibly the people involved, it was all consensual and wasn't shared with anyone else. But there are, again, situations where it could be more serious. We feel like the suggested solutions in Senate Bill 677 and 678 sufficiently address the need for accountability while also taking into account the sort of uniqueness of this situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go next.
Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the executive director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm here today with testimony and giving the apologies of District Attorney Bradbury, who was in conversation with the chair and Mr. Taylor on this previously. He had to be in court this morning. The district attorneys feel that Senate Bill 677 is a really good step toward recognizing the realities of teenagers. I can say as a parent of three, either former or current teenagers, I can totally understand how this bill is necessary. And we also really do appreciate the no prior offense and the victim under 12, eliminating the affirmative defense. The bill doesn't take into account a couple of things, and we have some issues with the bill written. The first and most importantly, the bill does not take into account the issue of dissemination, what the defendant does with the images. Were they sent to one friend? Were they sent to the entire high school? Did it go to 10 buddies, or was it posted on the internet? These cases do, as Shannon said, affect victims terribly. Nationally, they have been the cause of suicides in teenagers. If this portion of the bill is not changed, all prosecutors would have with something like this is an A misdemeanor, and that's a difficult thing to share with a victim or a family who becomes so terribly harmed by this. I think, dissemination of the images for reasons other than coercion or blackmail or extortion needs to be addressed, because sometimes it has nothing to do with blackmail or extortion or coercion. Sometimes it's just being blame mean. And I think that this has to be addressed in the affirmative defense portion. Secondly, the bill doesn't mention whether the victim has consented to the behavior, whether they surreptitiously photographed. I think that's something we want to think about. And lastly, I think the A misdemeanor exclusivity is a bit of a problem, because I think the district attorneys would still like the option of a felony for cases of dissemination, for example. I think the bill's a great first attempt to deal with this. I think it's necessary, and we want a Class A misdemeanor option, and I'm really happy about the work group. 678 poses a little bit more of a problem, and I guess I'm curious about what we're trying to get to, really. I'm a little concerned with the first line of Section 22, which says, when a person is convicted. Is that any person? I just want to make sure that doesn't mean people who just aren't the class of people we're talking about. And I think addressing 677 appropriately would be something that district attorneys would approve of. 678, I don't think that we can support. Thank you.
All right. Doug? For the record, my name is Doug Harkle Road. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and the Alliance is strongly supportive of 677, knowing that there's going to be a work group to maybe deal with a couple of these items that were just mentioned. I'd like to take a step back and just comment. What we're really trying to do here, as your counsel said, is have the law catch up with the technology. And the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance believes we really need to make that happen. 70 months in prison is a mandatory minimum sentence. It's too long for certainly the standard sexting. So, inappropriate use of a sexual image, it's a Class A misdemeanor for 7 different crimes. 2 of those crimes, by the way, are already Class A misdemeanors in the bill that are, and you could probably just take those out, but that was just it wasn't a Class A misdemeanor initially when it was drafted. It was drafted as a B, so that's why they're in there. The mitigating circumstances for those 7 crimes, under 18. By the way, nobody over 21 is going to get any of these defenses. This is a young person's bill. The 3-year limitation only applies if to children, and they can't be more than 18, so you add 3 years and you get to 21. So it's only under 21, just to let you know. Okay, nobody who's 22 is going to get this defense, 23 or older. It just does not apply. And that, it's not real clear from the bill, but that is what it says. The consideration, the coercion, and the theft takes you out. And that's probably the place where we need to talk about the dissemination and whether that takes you out of getting this affirmative defense and reducing it down. There's one other thing we might want to do in that work group. Right now, if a youth has been convicted of a sex crime, I'm talking about actually convicted, been in front of the judge, been sentenced, we don't have an exclusion for that youth. And so if there's a sodomy conviction or something like that, perhaps we don't want that person to get the affirmative defense and have it be now a misdemeanor if they've already been convicted in front of a judge and sentenced for a serious sex crime. That's something for the work group to take up. There's a statute that defines sex crimes. I took a quick look at it and who has to register, and I'm not proposing registration in this one. I don't think we want this person to register, but there is a list of crimes we can look at and figure out which one should be in, which one should be out. I like a lot the fact that the district attorney can independently just charge this as a misdemeanor. So they don't have to worry about the affirmative defense. They can just look and see that it fits the affirmative defense and charge it. That's a good thing. Okay.
then the defendant, frankly, doesn't have to prove that affirmative defense. The DA, those are factual matters, and they can figure that out. Regarding 678, I spent a lot of time studying Section 3 last night, which is the only difference in these two bills. And that, I'm going to do some more thinking about it after talking to Mr. Taylor, but my initial worry about that is that the mandatory, the mandatory minimums of set by Measure 11 and by the legislature that apply to 15, 16, and 17-year-olds, I believe for the crimes listed here, no longer are mandatory minimums because the judge now has discretion to not impose those mandatory minimums. Right now, that law doesn't allow. Doesn't give that judge the discretion. So that's an area I need to think about some more. That has bigger, broader implications. The last thing I would tell you is that there is a definition of previous conviction in this bill. And and the reason I raise this is because yesterday you had four bills in front of you, and I testified in opposition to those bills regarding how the definition of previous conviction. This previous conviction means a conviction or a finding of a juvenile court that was entered prior to the commission of the current offense. That's the definition I testified in opposition to yesterday on those other bills. I am not in opposition to that on this bill. And you say, why? The reason is because those other bills deal with much broader sentencing issues. This only deals with this affirmative defense, which reduces it down to a misdemeanor. It's a much, much narrower application, and it is a new crime that we're dealing with here. So that's the difference. That's all I have.
All right, thank you. Questions? Senator, I want to meet you first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I know the answer to this, but I'd really like confirmation. Does this in any way affect the recipient of one of the messages or just the transmitter? So what if there's a teenager who gets a picture? Does this impact them at all? Can they be charged with anything? Or is it just the person who sends it?
Mr. Chair, Doug Harkleroad, Chair Przanski, and Senator Bonamici, my opinion is that it does not apply to those victims, the person who receives the picture, if all they do is receive it.
Senator Przanski, Senator Bonamici, that's our reading of it as well. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The dialogue that you had on the victim consent is kind of intriguing when you start thinking about it, isn't it? If one of the partners is 20 and one is 18, the 18-year-old is capable of consent. But if they're 17 and 14, the 14-year-old is not capable of consent. Could you flesh that out a little bit more?
Senator Wissett, I think if I understand what the question is, I think, Doug, what he's talking about is when you're not able to give consent because of your age, but the law we have has a three-year defense, and we kind of say even though a child that's under 18 normally cannot give consent, there's a buffer for a defense if the conduct is between two individuals who are 3 years or less, if that's what I'm hearing you asking.
That's part of the question. Yes, that answers part of the question. The other part of the question is if they're 20 and 18, one of them, they're both capable of consenting. So, I mean, is there a crime committed if they both consented to the action?
We'll go counsel first.
Chair, members of the committee, if they're both adults and they take pictures of each other, that's not a crime. We're focusing, when all these laws focuses on Mr. Jerson, is the juvenile, in the sense that your basis for any kind of criminal sanctions for taking a picture of a juvenile is society protects kids. These pictures harm kids.
Did I misunderstand Mr. Harkold in saying this applied only to people under 21 years of age?
Chairman of the committee, but yes, but that relates back to the victim. The victim is under 18. You can have a defendant who's over 18, but it was within 3 years of the victim. So if you have a 19-year-old defendant and you have a 17-year-old victim, currently they are not guilty of a felony sex crime. There's no statutory rape for that age group. I think there's some misdemeanor offenses that can. There's one misdemeanor offense, and Doug may know this one better than I do, that can be charged, but it's not a felony. So the rationale here is that if displaying sexually explicit conduct does not have the 3-year age defense, you have a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old having sex with each other. That's not a felony, but if they take pictures of each other and disseminate that, it is a felony.
Thank you.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions or comments? Bill, you have your hand halfway up.
I do, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, one of the difficult issues here, and Josh and I put together a bill at your request. We then had a work group with the district attorneys. And one of the very difficult issues here is on dissemination. It's capable, possible to be under the statute if you have a young girl who takes a picture of herself. And now she sends it to a boyfriend and then sends it to a girlfriend. You have dissemination beyond one person. And if they each send it to 3 people, they may very well, they're probably within the statute too. If they then turn around and send it to 10 people, it gets into a very large number very quickly. And that's the difficulty in that area.
All right. Any other questions or comments? I've got 2 other people. Thank you all very much. The 2 that are scheduled to give testimonies, Craig Prince and Gil Meyer. And as they're coming up, I'm going to ask, is there going to be anyone else who will want to give testimony today on either of the 2 bills, Senate Bill 677 or 678? Craig? I'll let you go first because on Gail, she says neutral so far. So she's kind of teetering now. We're going to find out where she's at.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Council Taylor asked me to come and do a neutral factual overview. Frankly, I think you've covered everything I was going to cover. The only issue that I would raise is on Senator Bonamici's question about the, say youth A takes a photograph and then electronically sends it to his friend who has it on a cell phone. That would under 163.687, there are some of these statutes do apply to the possession of a image. So to be clear, as I read it, the affirmative defense would apply to a young person who had the picture and it wasn't taken. And so I don't know if that was what you had asked, but So does that clarify, Senator Bonamici, your question about the recipient of the photo? That could be a crime by just possessing the photo, controlling the photo, even if you didn't take it. And this affirmative defense does apply to that situation in the areas where Council Taylor
thank
went
you, over. If I may, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Prinz. And if that's the case, I would encourage the work group to look at that issue, whether that makes sense as policy that an innocent, unsuspecting teenager gets something and then could be charged.
Right.
If that's the case, we need a huge educational effort out to our teens about using the delete function on their phone.
Yes. Yes.
Chair, members of the committee, to confuse matters a little bit more, if I remember correctly, isn't this, Craig, the statute that the Oregon Supreme Court has pointed out in an issue where they found pornography on someone's computer, but it hadn't been downloaded? And that's another issue out there. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's a bill before your committee and the House committee to address this issue. It's once again the question of technology getting beyond the law.
And that was not a youth, though, is that correct? That was an adult?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. That is the difference.
So, Mr. Chair, I don't have any other comments.
Why don't you just stand by. We'll see if there's any other questions. Gail?
Thank you, Senator Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I simply want to say we appreciate the opportunity to address these issues. This
this incident is predominant in many of our case facts. A child, a youth could be contacted for a noise complaint, and the officers very frequently are just simply seizing their cell phones and looking through them. There's a vast number of cases where these are on there, and they may not even result in charges, but they do result in a heavy overlay of, because there's a possibility of a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence attached to simply what initially was some pretty innocuous behavior. I would also note that you could voluntarily take a picture of your own self, and you would still violate one of these statutes. So we do need to clean these up. We look forward to participating in the work group, and we'll be helpful in every way we can. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? All right, thank you. And again, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on either of the two bills, 677 or 678? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close those public hearings. And at this time, Council, I believe we had a couple of work sessions.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Have we received the fiscal, financial?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, we just got the fiscal and Senate bill 45 as it relates to the Dash 2 amendments.
Let me go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 45. Go ahead.
Senate Bill 45 comes in from the Department of Justice, and it standardizes a 30-day request for hearing in child proceedings, removes the presumption of inability to pay child support for those receiving foster care, and does certain other things too. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dash 2 amendments in front of you, and what happened here is they found afterwards some statutes where they had not. But their attempt here is to have everything as far as notice proceedings to be at 30 days. And they discovered a couple of statutes, ORS 2515, and 416, 448, where they have not put in the 30 days. And that's what this does here. Rather than have 60 days in this, that changes it to 30. So there's consistency throughout their statutes. We do have the fiscal, so this thing is ready to go. You'd have to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. And then.
All right. Let me just set for the record or make clarity. I know we had Senate Bill 45 up on the agenda this past Monday. We set it over till today to get the fiscal. And I don't have, with our electronic system, I don't have everything in front of me. I can't remember if we actually adopted any other amendments at that time.
We adopted the Dash 2 amendment.
Okay. That's why I knew we did, but I wasn't sure if it was a one or the two. So I believe we've got that in the record. And so at this time, I think all we need is a motion for the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 45 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor and pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 45 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And could I have a volunteer on Senate Bill 45?
Volunteer.
Senator Dinkeller will be our carrier on the bill. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 45. Open our work session on Senate Bill 522.
Senate Bill 522 comes to you from Senator Starr and basically authorizes a court to terminate parental rights of parent convicted of rape with respect to child conceived as a result of that rape. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have two sets of amendments in front of you. The Dash 1 remove the provision as it basically relates to what would be called statutory rape in common law. So that would say, and the issue here is concerned that if you have someone who's been convicted of statutory rape where he's 19 and a half and she's just under 18, you know, he's 20 and a half and she's just under 18, and they later get married, so the parental rights wouldn't have been be terminated.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that? And that's the Dash
1.
That's the Dash 1.
I'm sorry. Could you...
I'm going to ask Senator Starr to come up. This is a bill that he brought forward. There are two amendments. I hope that you had gotten word of those amendments. So we're going to bring you into the discussion once we get through this little part. I think there was a question to you.
I had a question about what the Dash 1 amendment did.
Chair members of the committee, let me just put the best thing for you to do is get the statute, if you could.
Okay.
Mr. Chair members of the committee, this removes what 163.355 which is rape in the third degree. A person commits a crime of rape in the third degree if the person has sexual intercourse with another person under the age of 16 years of age. It's a Class C felony. So you have the situation where a 15-and-a-half and an 18-and-a-half-year-old. I believe, was the issue that there was some concern about, that this would automatically terminate the parental rights. And at some point, they may decide to get married or whatever.
That's no longer part of that.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, that would take reference out to 163.355 out of the bill. On page 1, line 9, and page 2, line 12, and on line 36,
For the record and for, let's say, plain English, what we're saying is that if we have the scenario that you just described, mm-hmm. Where you have kids that are 3 years apart, we're not automatically going to extinguish the parental rights of the older child being, we're assuming that being the male, just because of the conduct that was involved in, there would still be the opportunity or approach where that could occur, but it wouldn't be automatic.
That's correct.
All right. Any other questions regarding the dash ones? Let's go ahead and say what the dash twos are. I want to put those on the record, then we're going to hear from Senator Starr.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the dash two, the Department of Justice contacted me about this, and I did bring up a copy of the amendment to Senator Starr's office last night. And what they're concerned about is when you terminate parental rights, you also terminate the obligation to pay child support. Now, in many cases, it may be difficult to get child support, but nonetheless, there may be the opportunity to do it. So what we did is clarify that does not relieve the parent of any obligation to pay child support.
All right, and that's fine. They came, agency came and talked to me, and I thought that was an appropriate thing for the committee to consider. The other part that they brought to my attention, and I'm not sure if anyone spoke to Senator Starr, and that was rights by heirship, such as if you have a person who had their parental rights terminated, and if, let's say, they became a millionaire and died, the child normally through state law would have some right to be a claimant under that estate. That does not appear to be, let's say, of any of the amendments. I just want to put that on the table because that was something that was brought to my attention to make certain before we move this forward, this is what we intend. Senator Starr, comments on 1, 2, or that last subject?
For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, Senator from Senate District 15 in Western Washington County. Appreciate the opportunity to comment. I believe the Dash 1 amendments accomplished the issue that Senator Bonamici raised in the hearing. Fully support those. The Dash 2 amendments, again, I think are appropriate, though I think in the real world, I think you're going to find moms who happen to have a child as a result of a rape are going to want nothing to do with the child's father. So my sense is this situation in the real world isn't going to be a problem. But I think it's appropriate to include it into the statute. As it relates to the other issue you raised, you're talking about that very small, minute exception that might be out there somewhere. Again, in the case that brought this issue to my attention, it was quite the opposite. The mother of the child wanted the perpetrator of the crime as far away as possible from not only her but the child. And, I think in most cases, obviously there will be exceptions to everything. And unfortunately, lots of times we legislate for those exceptions, obviously. But in most cases, I think that you're talking about something that's very, 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 very rare. And, at some point in the future, if the legislature needs to come back and address something, maybe that's an appropriate thing to do. I'll leave it up to the wisdom of the committee if it's something that you believe needs to be addressed in this bill at this particular time. I would stand by the committee's will or wisdom as it relates to that particular issue. As it relates to the dash ones and dash twos, I believe they're appropriate to include in the bill. I'd ask that they would be included in the bill. I appreciate Mr. Taylor's work on those. I appreciate the Department of Justice following the legislation and bringing the other issues to our attention. I'd ask that the bill be amended and moved through the process.
I just want to put that other one on the record. My perspective, we should probably move the bill as is with the amendments, and that is discussion that can occur on the House side if they want to look at it.
But I do want to put on the record, I know it may seem really arbitrary or facetious that you would see this, but if for some reason that child becomes a ward of the state more than likely would be looking for some type of satisfaction of the financial obligations the state incurs. And I think that's the reason we have the dash twos before us. And as they had brought to my attention, if, you know, even though the parent, the victim in this matter may want to have nothing to do, there's still a public policy that we've already said is in place as to whether that would or wouldn't still be there. It wouldn't be once you extinguish the parental rights. That's the only reason it was brought up. So with that, the chair will take a motion on the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 522.
Senator Cruz moves the dash ones into Senate Bill 522. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 522.
Senator Cruz now moves the dash twos into Senate Bill 522. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 522 as amended by the dash one and dash two amendments to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 522 as amended by the dash ones and the dash twos to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Open up for discussion, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have the fiscals for the dash one. We don't have the fiscals for the dash two. I am hard pressed to think that there is a fiscal, but nonetheless, we don't have fiscal for the dash two.
Okay, fine. So, Senator Cruz, would you like to retract your motion?
Not really, but I will.
Okay. And I wouldn't either, but I understand under the protocol, we don't want the president coming down to see us only in the fourth week. We have probably plenty of time for him to come visit us at later times of this year. So thank you for withdrawing your motion at this time. What we will do...
For the record, the ones and twos are in the bill, and
yes.
That's
yes.
Fine.
Mr. Chair, so. I just want to... We're still in work session, so I just want to make a comment. I appreciate Senator Starr agreeing to the Dash 1 amendment, which addressed my concern, and I certainly support Dash 1 and 2 amendments. And the only thing that concerns me, and I plan to support the bill, Mr. Chair, but the only thing that concerns me is the wording in Section 3 that says that except as provided in Subsection 5 in determining custody of a minor child under these statutes, the court shall give primary consideration to the best interest and welfare of the child. So I don't like making exceptions to the court considering the best interest of the child, because I think that should always be the best interest and welfare of the child should always be the primary consideration of the judge. I can't imagine a situation that meets the qualifications, because I think this is limited to those situations, that it wouldn't be in the best interest of the child, but I just, as a cautionary statement, don't think we should be chipping away at when the court can determine a decision based on the best interest and welfare of the child. So thanks for letting me.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that, we have ramped up in the discussion of best interest, relative placement is predominant. And in this case, this relative placement probably shouldn't be predominant. So.
Understood.
Okay. So here's where we're at. We do have the dash ones and the dash twos in Senate Bill 522. We are carrying the bill over till tomorrow. So if we actually get the fiscals between now and tomorrow, we'll do that. Senator Starr, what we will do, if we don't have them, we'll carry them over to the next day. I would expect we'll have them by Monday. And I assume that you'd like to be the carrier of the bill. And we'll denote that in on the record once we actually get everything finalized. So thank you for coming down. And with that, we're going to close the work session on 522. And we are scheduled to be here tomorrow at 8:30. Is there anything else we need to cover today,
Mr. Council? Chair, you say you want this bill back on tomorrow?
I want it carried over.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I have to combine the one and twos and get the three from Legislative Council's office and then send the Legislative Fiscal. I'm not sure if I can get the paperwork back on tomorrow.
Okay. All right. So let me just ask a question before you go there. So was there or was there not a request regarding just the dash twos to get the fiscal on it alone?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. But
okay.
I've been told I need to see the dash threes. Can I issue a fiscal?
What is the dash threes?
They're ones and twos combined.
Okay, and let's do it this way. We are still carrying the bill over till tomorrow. I will have a conversation with the president's office because, my concern is that if we've already got the request in, what I don't want to see, not necessarily on this bill, but ones in the future, that we have to delay everything to get another set of fiscal. It seems like we're asking for duplicitous work to be done if we've already had them on each of them individually. Senator Cruz.
I'm going to ask a question. If, and this sounds unusual to me, that we've adopted two amendments and then the amendments have to be combined when they're already adopted into the bill. That makes absolutely no sense because it's not changing anything. My question would be, if we had adopted the dash ones and not adopted the dash twos at this point in time, would they still want to combine them?
No, because we would have had the one and we already had the fiscal.
So the reason for that question, Mr. Chair, is if we're still in work session and we rescind the adoption of the dash twos and then we're just waiting for the FIS-RIS on that, does that simplify it? And then we adopt the dash twos when we have the statement with them. I don't know the answer.
At this point, since we have one committee member who's already left, I'm not ready to go there. What I am ready to do is make a trip to the principal's office.
I mean, you understand what I'm trying. I'm trying to expedite this.
I understand. Okay. I think I appreciate that. So at this point, the bill is carried over until tomorrow, and we'll find out what the protocol is going to be for this committee and others in the future as it pertains to fiscals on amendments. With that, we're adjourned until tomorrow at 8:30.